1945. Chapter 16. The Rhine Maiden. The American war correspondent, Lee Carson, was extremely beautiful. For many men, that was the first and sometimes the only thing they noticed about her. Even her fellow newspaper reporters went into impassioned raptures over her looks. Lee Carson has wavy red hair that hangs down to her shoulders and cool green eyes that light up when she talks and full red lips and a throaty laugh. And she has dimples, wrote one salivating journalist. When Lee crosses her legs, it's an event. She's something to look at. Because Lee Carson was so attractive, some of her male colleagues liked to imply that she had only succeeded in journalism by batting her eyelashes. This was, of course, tosh. In spite of her good looks, Carson was one of the finest war reporters of the 20th century. Resourceful, resilient, witty, and astonishingly brave. She had left school at 16 to join the Chicago Sun-Times. After working in the Washington Bureau and a stint on Good Housekeeping and Ladies' Home Journal, at the age of 22, she was sent to Britain to cover the D-Day landings as war correspondent for the International News Service. Women were officially barred from the front lines. But in June 1944, Carson persuaded a US pilot to smuggle her aboard a spotter plane, and she witnessed the bombing of Cherbourg, the only woman reporter to come close to the Normandy invasion. When she landed back in Britain, an army press officer berated her. "Don't you know an article of war states women are not allowed with combat troops?" "Sure," she replied, "I knew it, but it was my job to get the news. That came ahead of any articles of war or maidenly modesty." Mixing with the invasion troops, she was confusingly addressed as "Ma'am, sir." Wherever she went, Carson was met with cheering and catcalls from the American GIs. I always reminded them of their wives or sisters or sweethearts. Here I was, filthy dirty in ragged, muddy jacket and trousers, and just the fact that I was an American girl was enough. They thought, well, if she's here, hell, it can't be that bad. In August, Carson was confined to a hotel in Rennes with a dozen other women correspondents as Allied troops converged on Paris. She broke out, attached herself to a unit of the Fourth Army, and rode into the French capital in a jeep with the Reuters correspondent Bob Rubin. She insisted on sitting in the front seat, which made her the first journalist into liberated Paris. The writer Ernest Hemingway was later celebrated for liberating the bar of the Paris Ritz, running up a tab for 51 dry martinis. But he reached Paris after Lee Carson, who preferred highballs. No woman was ever officially accredited to a fighting unit, yet Carson attached herself to the American First Army press camp, along with the British-born Boston Globe correspondent Iris Carpenter. They designed their own uniforms, a khaki denim boiler suit belted at the waist. A few weeks later, as the Allied troops fought their way eastwards in pursuit of the retreating Germans, Carson was driving on a rutted road when her jeep swerved and overturned at 60 miles an hour. She survived, but tore open an old appendectomy wound. The army medics patched her up, and did so again when she broke her hand diving into a foxhole under fire. For the next 6 weeks, Carson typed one-handed on a German portable typewriter she had found in an abandoned dugout. At Eschweiler, on the Siegfried Line, the defensive line running along Germany's western border, she came under sustained mortar bombardment in a ruined house. "For 2 days we lay there, with the walls coming down around our ears. Then we decided to get out." During the Battle of the Bulge, she described the German planes zooming down from the pink-streaked winter skies to shower our frontline positions with streams of hot lead and tearing the world apart with their heavy artillery barrages. Some of her frontline companions remained perplexed by her gender. Lee Carson is a regular guy to travel within the field, one wrote. She does a man's job, and the way she does it wins the admiration of her competitive colleagues. She is constantly the subject of whistles, shouts, and wisecracks, but she just takes it in her stride. Lee Carson went wherever she wanted, and no one dared stop her. For in addition to her beauty and journalistic skills, she had a formidable temper. In December 1944, Carson reported the Malmedy massacre, where the Waffen-SS slaughtered 84 disarmed American POWs. She spent Christmas Day in a shell hole. As the First Army pushed deeper into Germany, Carson went with them. She described the battle-stained First Army doughboys, with rifles slung over their shoulders and beard-stubbled chins, and watched American army engineers labouring to lay pontoon bridges across the Rhine. Machine gun fire poured across the river. They fought the current, they fought the enemy, they fought cold, wet and fatigue, and they fought time. The soldiers called her the Rhine Maiden. At Berendorf, she watched 70 members of Hitler's Home Guard, the Volkssturm, meekly laying down their weapons. "We didn't fight," their leader told her. "What was the point?" There was no point, and yet some fought on. By mid-March, the First Army and Lee Carson were approaching the Mulder River. Beyond lay the last significant Nazi military resistance. The Volkssturm might be made up of old men and teenagers armed with anti-tank weapons they could hardly lift, but the holdouts also included hardened SS units ready to fight to the death. In his final broadcast, Hitler railed against Jewish Asiatic Bolshevism, calling on every able-bodied German to resist the invaders with the utmost fanaticism. And of all the places to make a futile and bloody last stand, none was more appropriate, or more defensible, than the vast castle on the hill built by ancient German princes as a symbol of overweening power. As the Allies advanced, Colditz steadily filled up with Allied generals, British aristocrats, and other notables. Eggers remarked with dark irony that the Nazi leadership seemed to be making a last-minute shuffle through Debrett's, the Bible of British genealogy, in search of more blue-blooded prisoners to take hostage. Someone in Berlin seemed to be laying down a grotesque insurance policy, collecting together individuals of value to be cashed in when the end came. Eggers wondered what the exchange rate might be. Who was going to be offered for whom in the final bunker in Berlin? Who or how many would be suggested in exchange for the Führer, for Himmler, and so on? On the 19th of January, 1945, four generals arrived in two army cars from the French officers' camp at Königstein. Eggers was told to expect a third car carrying a fifth French general, Gustave Meyny, commander of the North African Infantry, who had been captured in 1940. The car never appeared. The next day brought word that Meyny had been shot on the Autobahn while attempting to escape. He has been buried in Dresden with full military honours by a detachment of the Wehrmacht, Pravit announced. The reality was starkly different. Back in October, German General Fritz von Brodowski had been captured by French resistance forces in eastern France and subsequently killed in Besançon Castle, possibly in retaliation for the mass murder of 643 French civilians at Oradour-sur-Glane, an atrocity carried out by Waffen-SS troops, ultimately under von Brodowski's command. Enraged, Hitler demanded the execution, in retaliation, of a captive French general. The SS discussed various ways of carrying out the Führer's order, including a plan to construct an airtight partition between the front and rear seats of a car and place the intended victim in the back. Odorless carbon monoxide gas will be introduced during this drive into the inner compartment through a special apparatus to be controlled from the front seat. A few breaths will suffice to ensure death. The gas being odorless, there is no reason for the general to become suspicious at the decisive moment and break the windows in order to let in fresh air. The Reich was disintegrating, but SS executioners were still dreaming up imaginative and efficient ways to gas their enemies. Of the five French generals, Meini was selected at random by SS Oberst Friedrich Meurer, chief of staff to Obergruppenführer Gottlob Berger of the SS High Command. In the end, the killing was quite simple. The car carrying Meini, driven by SS officers disguised in Wehrmacht uniforms, stopped in a wood off the motorway between Königstein and Kolditz. Hauptmann Schweinitzer, an officer on Himmler's general staff, swiveled in the front passenger seat, shot the French general in the heart at point-blank range, and then dropped off the corpse at Dresden Military Hospital. The assassination was not even a propaganda exercise or a warning to the resistance, since it was immediately hushed up. Planned by Berger, the new Uber-commandant of the prison camps, and carried out by his underlings, this squalid, secret, tit-for-tat murder served no purpose other than to slake Hitler's desperate bloodthirst as his Reich went down in flames. The French generals were followed into Kolditz a few weeks later by an equally distinguished military contingent of Poles, led by General Tadeusz Bor-Komorowski, commander-in-chief of the secret Polish Home Army that had resisted Nazi occupation for 5 long years. In August 1944, with Soviet forces advancing on central Poland, Bor-Komorowski led the Warsaw Uprising against the Germans and took over most of the capital. The Red Army, however, stopped at the city's eastern edge beyond the Vistula River and ignored Polish pleas for help, enabling the Germans to regroup and launch a ferocious counterattack. The street fighting continued for 63 days. More than 16,000 Polish resistance fighters were killed, along with thousands of civilians murdered by the Nazis in mass executions. Stalin may have deliberately allowed the uprising to fail, ensuring his troops could march into Warsaw unopposed once the Polish resistance had been destroyed. Without Soviet support, surrounded and outgunned, Bor-Komorowski finally surrendered in exchange for a German promise to treat his captured soldiers as prisoners of war under the Geneva Convention. He and 15,000 of his men were marched off to camps in Germany. Bor-Komorowski was a small, bald, wiry cavalryman who had received a medal on behalf of the Polish equestrian team from Hitler himself at the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games. He loathed the communists as much as he detested Nazis. When Eggers dared to ask him whether he would prefer German or Russian occupation, he spat. "Even if you occupy my country for 20 years, both of you, my people will remain Polish." Julius Green thought the Polish general could have been mistaken for a solicitor's clerk until you took a close look and saw the steely eyes and air of ruthless determination. Bor-Komorowski and his entourage of 5 generals, 9 other senior officers and 7 orderlies took up residence in the Promenente quarters. "It has been a pleasure to hear Polish voices again," wrote Padre Platt. The days passed in a strange clatter of contrasts. Buoyancy and gloom, industry and lassitude, fear and absurdity. Mickey Byrne rushed to finish his novel before the war ended. Yes, Farewell was an accurate fictionalised portrait of Kolditz, but also a disguised socialist manifesto, declaring the old class structure dead and buried. Its heroes were the orderlies, solid men of simple virtue. With his fellow communist Giles Romilly, Byrne continued to lecture on the virtues of the Soviet Union, General Bor Komorovsky was persuaded to give a contrasting and equally passionate talk, simultaneously translated by his aide, on the perils of Russian duplicity. The glider took shape in the attics. Floriman Duke lectured on Anglo-American relations, pointing out that one of the main differences between the British and Americans was the language. Duke's role as senior American officer had taken on new significance with the arrival of an American soldier facing imminent execution. In Shubin Camp, Colonel William Schaefer had prevented a German NCO from pinning up the notice declaring that escape from prison camps is no longer a sport, a serious breach of prison discipline. In Leipzig, he was court-martialed and sentenced to death, a verdict personally approved by Hitler. The condemned man was sent to Colditz to await execution, and now languished in solitary confinement, smoking endless cigarettes. "His nerves were not up to it," wrote Rudolf Denzler, the Swiss official. "He lost his hair and teeth." The bread ration was reduced still further. Platt noticed that some officers were squirreling supplies. "They are so afraid of the wolf that they dare not eat the food that is in their hands." Julius Green's imaginary dinners were taking on a hallucinatory quality, but the dentist continued to dream up impossible banquets as the food ran out. He now believed he had perfected the ideal imaginary menu. Smoked salmon, minestrone, roast beef, pineapple and kirsch, followed by coffee and a good brandy. The inhabitants of Colditz were hungry, but they were nowhere near as famished as the desperate lines of German refugees toiling through the town below. A wave of starving humanity hurled from their homes by the advancing Allied armies. They looked a heart-rending sight, trudging brokenly across the bridge. Some carried small bundles, but some could barely carry themselves. On the 10th of February, a very appreciative audience packed into Colditz Theatre to see They Came to a City, J.B. Priestley's play about the hopes and fears of people moving to a model city. 3 days later, more than 1,200 British and American bombers converged on Dresden, the last major German city as yet unscathed by bombing. Over the next 2 days, some 25,000 people were killed, and a cultural landmark was obliterated in one of the most ferocious acts of war ever carried out. "It is not possible to describe," said one survivor. "Explosion after explosion. It was beyond belief, worse than the blackest nightmare." The prisoners could see the conflagration taking place 30 miles to the east. Those who could not bear to watch felt the bombardment reverberating through the castle walls. "The old Schloss rocked, dropping dust and plaster," wrote Platt. Many of the German guards were from Dresden. Eggers gave his clerk permission to return to the city to search for his family. When he got home, he found the house burned out and his family all dead. Appalled by the carnage taking place on the horizon, the padre requested permission to take a parole walk in the countryside. For the first time in months, Platt left the castle and walked beside the Mulder, a guard trailing behind him. A chaffinch burst into song. Coaltits were singing their eager, nervous little ditty and flitting through the apple trees. Here was innocent birdsong in a tranquil valley, while just a few miles away, men burned each other to death in multitudes. A rumour swirled around the castle that all the prisoners would soon be transferred to the Bavarian Redoubt, where the Nazis were expected to make their last stand. Colonels Todd and Duke requested a meeting with the commandant and asked what steps would be taken when Allied forces reached Colditz. Pravit replied vaguely, but also truthfully, that he had no instructions on this point. Rudolf Denzler returned for what he hoped would be a final inspection. The Swiss official found the castle feverish with uncertainty, but his presence seemed to lend the prisoners courage. His twinkling pince-nez and avuncular sociability turned the edge of doubt. "How much longer?" he was asked, as another formation of Allied bombers droned overhead. "Not much longer," he replied, with an optimism he did not feel. Denzler knew the prisoners had never been in greater peril. The rule of law was dissolving in Germany, and with it his ability to protect them. The castle was like a ship threatened by a storm just before reaching harbour, he wrote. Former inmates were also watching from a distance, with mounting unease, as the hurricane rolled closer to Colditz. From Switzerland, Pat Reed wrote to the Foreign Office, expressing serious alarm for the safety and lives of the POWs at Colditz and demanding that something be done to protect them or enable them to defend themselves. "The officers and prominenti of Colditz will be held as hostages," Reed predicted. "The POWs will, at a specified moment, be moved from Colditz to the centre of the Nazi ring, wherever that may be." His plan for liberating the castle was radical. "Blow the garrison courtyard and the guardhouse to bits by very low, accurate bombing. Drop arms in the inner courtyard and give the officers a chance for their lives. They will do the rest." Pierre Mérès Lebrun had a similar idea in mind, but even more flamboyant. With the same panache that had sent him sailing over the perimeter wire in 1941, he intended to liberate Colditz in person, with his own army. The dashing French cavalry officer had crossed the Rhine south of Strasbourg with the Liberation Army, and he now approached General Jean de Lattre de Tassigny, commander-in-chief of French forces in Germany, with a suggestion. "I knew of the Prominente, and I was convinced that they, if not every POW in Colditz, all known as Deutschfeindlich, would become hostages to be held as such or massacred in the last resort." Mérès Lebrun asked de Lattre to give him two squadrons of tanks with supplies and ammunition for a lightning thrust to Colditz, some 300 miles to the northeast. "Germany was beginning to crumble," he wrote. "Whatever I did had to be done quickly." De Lattre approved the plan, and Mérès Lebrun was preparing for a glorious dash to Colditz when the scheme was scuppered by the Americans, who feared, rightly, that this independent relief force might collide with the advancing Russians and trigger an embarrassing conflict. The fears of Pat Reed and Pierre Mérès Lebrun were fully shared in London, Paris, Washington, and General Eisenhower's Supreme Allied Headquarters. What fate did Hitler intend for the vast population of men he still held prisoner? If the camps were simply abandoned, many inmates would undoubtedly die of starvation and disease, or face reprisals from the local population. If they were marched deeper into Germany ahead of the Allied armies, men already enfeebled by malnutrition would surely perish on the way. Would Hitler corral some, or even all of them, into his final stronghold as hostages, a human shield against aerial bombardment? Or would the SS simply slaughter them all in a final, horrific Götterdämmerung? In February, at Sunningdale Golf Course, southwest of London, the newly formed Special Allied Airborne Reconnaissance Force began training 120 three-man teams to rescue thousands of endangered POWs. Recruited from British and American Special Operations Units, the SOE and OSS, these heavily armed agents would parachute into the collapsing Reich with radio sets and infiltrate the prison camps. Once inside, they would contact the senior British officer and open radio communications with advancing Allied troops, which would then drop arms and supplies and give air cover while the garrison was overpowered. The plan to seize control of the POW camps from within was appropriately codenamed Eclipse. three teams were allotted to Colditz, including one led by Patrick Lee Fermor, the scholar, writer, and soldier who had already successfully operated behind the lines in Crete. With Henry Coombe Tennant, an escaped POW who would go on to become a Benedictine monk, Lee Fermor began forging plans to liberate Colditz before the SS got there. But they were too late. In early March, Irmgard Wernicke and her messenger, the young German guard Heinz Schmidt, passed on a grim rumour circulating around town. SS squads had arrived with orders to kill the prisoners when the time came. The Colditz intelligence unit, run by David Sterling and Cecho Kalupka, was proving highly effective. Astonishingly, the older Schmidt had successfully bribed the telephone operator of the Colditz switchboard to note down all calls to the commandant from Berlin and Dresden. More and more often, the calls came from SS and Gestapo sources. At the same time, another of Schmidt's spies inside the Kommandantur reported seeing a letter on Pravitt's desk, signed by Hitler, saying that the Prominente were under no condition to be allowed to fall into Allied hands. Something unpleasant was brewing. If the order came to move the VIP hostages or carry out a massacre, it would certainly be relayed through the Dresden offices of Martin Mutschmann, the Gauleiter of Saxony, who had visited the castle in triumph to inspect the discovered French tunnel in 1942. As befits the founder of the SAS, David Sterling launched a preemptive strike. A strongly worded and threatening letter, in idiomatic German, handwritten in Gothic script, and personally addressed to Mutschmann. "Your day in power is over," it began. "Now you face death." The letter went on to warn that if any harm came to prisoners in Colditz, the Allies would see to it that he was hanged. It was unsigned, but phrased as if it had come from the growing anti-Nazi German resistance. Mutschmann was the most powerful man in Saxony, but he was also a coward. And with Armageddon looming, some senior Nazis were actively exploring how to save their own hides. We hoped it might give the Gauleiter some worried moments and perhaps make him think twice in a crisis, wrote Jack Pringle. The letter was passed on from Heinz Schmidt to Irma Wernicke, who took the train to what remained of Dresden and posted it. The prisoners had spent more than 4 years trying to get out of the castle. Now, it seemed, they might have to fight the Germans in order to stay in it. Colonel Todd began making resistance plans. If an attempt was made to move them, the staircases would be blocked with furniture. A battering ram was constructed in the attic to be used, if necessary, to break down the door to the armory. Julius Green prepared an emergency medical kit of drugs and dressings for use in case of attack or forcible eviction. The glider was ready to fly. What had once been an escape tool was now seen as a way to send two men to get help if the SS closed in. "The glider is to be held in reserve in strict secrecy," Todd ordered. If the Germans attempted to seize the Prominente, evacuate the prisoners or kill them all, the move would come without warning. "Whatever was going to happen to us would happen soon," wrote one officer. Irma and her network were closely monitoring local troop movements and other menacing signs, but alerting the prisoners in the event of an emergency would take time. "We could not wait for meetings with Heinz, which could only take place every other night when he came on guard." The intelligence unit and its spies in the village devised an early warning system. 300 feet below the castle, on the street at the foot of the hill, stood a lamppost, clearly visible from the windows of the British quarters. In collaboration with Irma, Heinz and his father, a simple visual code was agreed. Every day, at 9 a.m., 12 p.m. and 4 p.m., a trusted man would appear at this signal site. If he simply leaned on the lamppost for a few minutes and then walked away, this meant nothing to report. If he crossed the road, it would indicate, "You are to be moved." If he lit a cigarette, it sent the message, "German troops are pulling out." The fourth signal was the most complicated and the most feared. If the agent walked in the centre of the road, past the restaurant, halted at the first telegraph pole on the left for half a minute, and then returned to the lamppost, he was signalling, "Extreme danger. Come out at all costs." This would be the trigger for the prisoners to launch a mass breakout, armed with whatever weapons they could find. The signal would be made only if the castle was to be blown up or the SS was mustering for a full-scale assault. Every day, three times a day, a lookout trained a homemade telescope on the lamppost. But even with forewarning, the prisoners could not hold out for long. In the end, their fates would depend on whether the Colditz garrison opted to defend the inmates from the SS or surrender them. One morning after roll call, Todd addressed the prisoners. "Gentlemen, there comes a time when things get so bad, all one can do is laugh." He continued, unsmiling. "The Germans have informed me that there will be over 1,000 French officers coming here in the next few days." The French prison camp east of Leipzig had been evacuated ahead of the Soviet advance, and its inmates herded westward. By the time they reached Colditz, they had been driven, like cattle, for almost a week, and were in the most terrible state, unshaven, unwashed, and smelling to high heaven in their filthy clothes. Eggers watched them tramp in like a barbarian horde. Some 1,200 were crammed into the castle, with a further 600 imprisoned in a makeshift camp outside the town. The British were moved into the Keller House basement to make room, but there were not enough beds for all. The overspill slept on straw spread on the floor of the chapel and in the latrines. "With 2,000 near-starving men on our hands," wrote Eggers, "the food shortage was desperate." The drain swiftly blocked up. The hot water stopped. Famished prisoners brewed a gritty and tasteless broth from potato and turnip peelings scraped off the kitchen floor. When even more ravenous prisoners arrived, Eggers distributed a single slice of bread and jam to each, with his revolver drawn, to prevent them from stealing each other's meagre rations. The air raid sirens sounded day and night. "All is jostle and racket and apology and smell," complained the padre. When the fuel finally ran out, a handful of prisoners were allowed outside the walls, on parole, to collect fallen wood in the Tiergarten. One of the foragers wrote, "As we walked back into the yard, the prison smell hit us in the face." Colditz was descending into a freezing, stinking, starving vision of purgatory. Into this hellhole, on the 6th of April, strode an oddly angelic figure. A fair-haired young man with steel-blue eyes and a sensitive character. The last prisoner into Colditz and the latest addition to the exclusive ranks of the Prominente. Lieutenant John Wynant, Jr., had been a 21-year-old sophomore at Princeton when he quit university to enlist in the U.S. Air Force. He flew 13 missions over Germany before his B-17 Flying Fortress bomber was shot down near Münster in 1943. He parachuted from the stricken plane and was swiftly captured. Wynant was just another POW, except that his father was the U.S. ambassador to Britain. A former governor of New Hampshire, tipped by some as a possible future president, John G. Wynant Sr., had been appointed America's ambassador to the Court of St. James by Roosevelt in 1941, and would remain in that post throughout the war. Ambassador Wynant was a popular figure and a champion of the war effort, whose desire for close Anglo-American bilateral relations even extended to having an affair with Churchill's daughter Sarah. So when news reached Britain that Wynant's eldest son and namesake had been taken prisoner, the American embassy in London was flooded with letters and telegrams from well-wishers in the United States, Great Britain, and other countries. The young pilot had spent 18 months in a POW camp near Munich when he was abruptly transferred to Colditz. John Wynant was rather baffled to have been thus singled out, but it soon became clear why he had been brought there. The son of the American ambassador could be a valuable pawn. He was, in face and figure, and in all else, the Englishman's idea of an American college boy, observed Michael Alexander, with a flicker of English hauteur when Wynant was ushered into their quarters. The clutch of Colditz VIPs now included Polish and French generals, British aristocrats, politicians' relatives, members of the royal family, and one famous young American. The chips were down, and someone in Berlin was putting together what might prove to be a winning hand. We never discovered exactly who it was among Hitler's entourage who was looking for a likely swap in his own personal interests by horse trading in hostages, wrote Eggers. The probable answer was Himmler himself, who had retained personal control of the department overseeing prisoner affairs. 4 days after Wynant's arrival, the fighting to the west became clearly audible. The Americans had now reached Halle, 25 miles from Leipzig, and were advancing swiftly in the direction of Colditz. A ragged stream of German tanks and armoured cars rumbled through the town, heading south towards Chemnitz, where the Wehrmacht Area Command had set up a new headquarters, an army facing oblivion, with nowhere to go. "People are constantly staring out of the windows in a westerly direction," wrote Grizz Davis Scarfield. "Others are busy packing." But not every German soldier was retreating. A force of 200 men from the 101st Motorized Rifle Battalion, led by SS officers and supported by tanks, moved into the town and began preparing for a last-ditch defence. The prisoners watched as members of the Hitler Youth dug trenches and foxholes in the slope opposite the castle. The SS barricaded the main street and established defensive positions inside houses on the outer edges of the town. The Volkssturm Battalion was mustered, armed with a handful of rifles and a couple of Panzerfaust handheld anti-tank warheads. They unrolled barbed wire across the bridge over the Mulde, and then stood around uncertainly. Several tanks and motorized artillery took up positions in the woods overlooking the valley. The SS officer in command appeared at the castle gates and demanded to see the commandant. His orders were to make a stand at the river, he told Pravit and Eggers, and he would need all the men and munitions that we could muster. Pravit explained that his garrison had been reduced to just 200 men, all aged over 50, armed with ancient French rifles and a dozen rounds of ammunition each, 10 machine guns and a few hand grenades. Some 700 of the French officers had been shifted to another camp, but the castle was still rammed with hungry, nervous and increasingly unmanageable prisoners. He would need every guard just to keep them from mounting an insurrection. The SS Hauptmann reluctantly agreed, but something in the commandant's manner had alerted him to a hint of disloyalty. He left with a warning. If white flags were raised on the castle, he would shoot the place up. Every day at 9 a.m, midday and 4 p.m, the signaller leaned on the lamppost below the castle. Nothing to report. Yet the feverish defensive preparations confirmed Irma Wernicke's warnings. Colditz was becoming a battle zone. Once again, Willy Todd and Florimond Duke asked to see Pravit. American troops would reach Colditz within days, if not hours. What were his intentions? Again, Pravit temporized, saying he was awaiting orders, He did not reveal that those orders had already been drawn up by Himmler himself, along with an emergency system of coded messages to put them into action. If the Area Command Headquarters telephoned through the code word Heiden-Röslein to the Commandant, this was the signal to evacuate the Prominente. The choice of word was deliberate. Heiden-Röslein is the title of a celebrated poem by Goethe. When a young lover goes to pick the rose of the heath, the rosebud does not give up without drawing blood. Said the boy, "I'll now pick thee, heath rose fair and tender." Said the rosebud, "I'll prick thee, so that thou'lt remember me. Never will I surrender." On receipt of the coded signal, Prawitz's orders were to assemble the VIP prisoners at the outer gate. The SS would send a squad of stormtroopers and two buses to collect them. Prominente would then be transferred further east to the fortress at Königstein, behind the dissolving German front line. The second coded signal was even more dramatic. If headquarters sent the letters ZR, this stood for Zerstörung, Räumung, destruction, evacuation. All documentary evidence in Colditz should be burned, remaining food stocks and weapons gathered up, the prison evacuated, and the inmates moved out at gunpoint using whatever transport is available. This amounted, Eggers noted, to one antique vehicle, barely working, and two horse-drawn carts. The prisoner should then be taken to the east. The order did not specify where. As a Methodist minister, Padre Platt felt it was incumbent on him to exhibit a devout and dignified aspect at all times. But his diary entry for the 12th of April, written in bed after the prisoners had been locked into their quarters, was as close as he ever came to giddy overexcitement. Army trucks, armoured cars and tanks have streamed over the bridge all day, an army in retreat. The German army personnel, armour and convoys are perhaps making for Berchtesgaden, Hitler's hilltop retreat in Bavaria, where, rumour says, the last stand will be made. By 10 a.m., we had a rumour of an American army having reached the Elbe. By midday, they were reported to be 12 miles from Leipzig. Artillery has been plainly heard since 1:30. The camp was in a furore of excitement, and every inch of window space was crowded with leaning, crushing bodies. Tonight, we have a red-hot rumour of a large tank concentration 4 miles west of Colditz. The announcement of the death of President Roosevelt came over the air. Defence preparations continued around the village more furiously. Slit trenches could be seen everywhere in the fields on the higher slopes and bordering the woods. Boys and girls of all ages could be seen at work with spades and pickaxes alongside their elders in uniform. The Germans look as if they are going to make a serious stand in the country around the castle. The senior British officer has gone to interview the commandant. On what subject, we do not know. The subject was the Prominente. That afternoon, a one-word message had arrived on Gerhard Prawitz's desk. Heiden-Röslein.